Hi, I'm Mike. I'll be teaching today a seminar on visualization and graphics with processing. The way I've organized this is that you can basically take these slides and take the basic building blocks I present here and just build your own application. So it should be fairly straightforward after this lecture that you can just go install processing and do your own visualization. I've also included at the end two advanced examples. One of them is a map of the US with some visualization on top of it, and the second one would be a tree map of one of Mark Twain's novels. So hopefully that will be useful for you guys for final projects. So part one, it's basically I'm going to do kind of like Lego blocks for processing. Processing is this Java-based language invented by some folks at MIT. You can download it for free at processing.org, and it has a ton of references and examples. So I recommend you go there. There are a bunch of very cool projects, such as the Genome Visualization Project created here at Harvard by Professor Pfister's lab, the MSR Academic Visualization Project, in which you can visualize the academic relationship between different professors and authors of papers, visualizing connections on the internet, similar to PageRank on Google. And here we can visualize file systems using, again, the same graph topology. So there are many applications of this, especially in research. There are different versions of doing visualization, different languages to do that. There's Flash, there's Microsoft has a different one. There's processing, which is free. But I recommend for your final projects to do processing. So it's very easy to learn. That's the main advantage. And if you know Java, it will be immediate for you. The syntax is very similar to C also. So the first block is just getting started. You have two functions. You have setup and draw. In the setup function, you create a window, basically your canvas. You create a canvas. And then you can also call functions to load your data sets here. And whatever, this function only gets called once. So whatever you want to be pervasive throughout the program, you can define here. The second one is called draw. This is refreshed something like 60 times a second or so for every, it's basically generating a frame. Each call to draw generates a separate frame. So this will be called many times a second. And pretty much all that you will see will be created inside the draw function. So let's do the first program of Hello World. You have a setup function, size of 400, 400, that's 400 by 400 window. Smooth just means that you have anti-aliasing enabled. I'll explain that in a minute. The draw function here basically just does one thing. If I press my mouse button, I fill with black. Otherwise, it's white. And this is a circle because the ellipse has identical width and height at the position of mouse X and mouse Y. So why don't we run that? This is the code, and we're going to try to run it. This is the processing IDE. There are several buttons here you might find useful. This is the run. It does the compilation running in one step. This is stop if you want to stop the execution of your of whatever file you're creating. There are a few important things such as sketch add file. This allows you to, whenever you have a file that you don't create in processing, such as a library, or if you are creating, for instance, you have some large data set, a text file, you want to add it to your sketch so it is viewable by this program. So you're going to say add file tolstoy.txt or whatever. And you can also import libraries. Import library is done separately. The way to import a library is if you have your own custom-made library that you download from some site, you copy it inside the folder of your processing sketch, you restart processing, and it should appear in this panel automatically. So that shouldn't be too bad. And then you can set the ID preferences, such as text size and all that stuff inside preferences. If you're using a very large data set, I suggest you also click increase available memory. Sometimes you might need to do that if you have a very large data set. You can increase it to whatever your maximum amount of memory is. So, and of course we have save. the cool thing is export application, which will create a Java applet for you. So you can also save this as a Java applet. It will also create a website for you. So you can just edit the HTML in that website it processing creates for you, and then you know you have your really cool visualization already done for you. The only caveat to that is that you have to, whoever will view your website has to have Java installed on their computer. Okay, let's look on this. So we have the console here, which shows you error messages. The error messages are very explicit usually, such as the function ellipse does not exist. Function names in processing usually start with lowercase letters, so you can just say ellipse with lowercase e. It will turn orange, which means correct syntax, so now you can run the program. And now we see that we have a circle that moves with my mouse. Awesome. Okay. So let's move on to more complicated things. So you've seen here we have in the lower part, if you have an error, it will be highlighted in orange. It highlights you the line where you have the bug, so it's very easy to debug. Now I'm going to talk about primitives in Draw. So one thing you have to keep in mind is the origin of your coordinate system is here, upper left corner. That's 0, 0. And then the y-axis goes down, and the x-axis goes like this. So you have to take that into account whenever you draw stuff. So whenever you want to fill with color something, you call the fill function. That takes either 0 to 255, which is a grayscale value. 0 is black, 255 is white. Or it can take 3 or 4 parameters. 3 parameters if you have 3 color channels, RGB. Those also go from 0 to 255. And the fourth parameter will be the transparency. So you can have 50% transparency, 100% transparency, all that stuff. Transparency is very useful, especially if you're doing layering of several layers of whatever visualization data sets. If you want to layer data sets, you might want to use transparency. Okay. So the basic shapes are a point, a line, a triangle, a rectangle. Here again, XY is the top left corner of the rectangle. It has a height and a width. The ellipse, an arc. The start and the stop are in radians. And if you want to do a Pac-Man application, you want to use an arc of some sort. It's basically, why don't I actually run the Pac-Man application for you guys? So I made a little Pac-Man application. The setup again. You might want to set up a background color. This is just saying that my background color is white. And here I'm representing motion. I'll go into this in a second. I just wanted to show you guys the arc. So this is what an arc looks like. I have the start and the stop, and the height and width are the same as for an ellipse. So it's basically an arc. Okay. Again, careful, start and stop are not in degrees, are in radians. So drawing order is important. So the last line in your draw function will be the foremost plane. So the thing you will see on top will be whatever shape you've drawn last. And then you can look back with your code and see which one will be the lower, the furthest plane from you. So that's how you can do layering in your visualization. Radians is a very useful function. You can just call radians of x. It will convert the value of x from degrees to radians. Stroke is just the outline of a shape. It's basically your pen. I can have a different width of the stroke. You can have a thicker outline of whatever shape you're drawing. So that's what stroke is for. You can remove the outline by using no stroke. That's what I usually do in my visualizations. You can also change the weight of the contour by saying stroke weight and then x, that's in values of point width. You can experiment with that. Smooth is used to reduce aliasing. You can disable that using no smooth. So I'm sure you've seen this in text. If you zoom in to a text too much, you will see the zigzagged shape for your text. Or whenever you play a video game, you might see that as well, at the edges of shapes. So anti-aliasing is basically you're smoothing out these edges. It's a bit more, the process is a bit more complex, But generally, you might want to just use the smooth function. Make stuff look better. If you're interested in how this works in detail, you should take CS175, which is graphics. Okay, basically everything can be disabled by using no in front of it. So no fill, no stroke, whatever. The alpha value is the transparency. And the fourth parameter is just optional to fill and stroke. You can create your own custom shapes. So if you wanted to draw something like the head of a cat, right? You might want to, you will have to draw that manually. So you can define your own shape by saying begin shape and end shape, and whatever calls to vertex will be in here. So vertex are basically points for your shape. You can, if we have like an arrow, we have several vertices, and processing will automatically draw lines between them. So that's how you can create whatever custom shape you might want to create. I'm going to show you an example with an arrow. So here I have my custom shape. I've included several calls to vertex, so those will bound my shape. And you can also see here I've written print line. Print line is the same thing as print file, except it prints to the console. So to show you that this is drawn once per frame, I'm going to print drawing frame and frame count. And the outcome is an arrow, which is what I've drawn using begin shape, end shape, and vertices defined in between. So each vertex, here we have one vertex, another vertex, another vertex, another vertex, another vertex. So that's how you can create your own shapes. You can see here we have the drawing frame. Frame count is additive, so when I started, I would start with 60, and then every time I would add 60 to that frame count. So that's why it's shown as 1,200 something. But you can see this is being called many times a second. That was my point here. So the good part about processing is that variables, logic, comments, virtually all syntax is nearly identical to C. So in this case, the only thing that I would consider substantially different is how I declare arrays. This is an object-oriented programming language. Just like JavaScript, you've learned JavaScript is object-oriented. You will have to use the same. If you want to create some kind of complex visualization, you might want to use the same concepts of object-oriented programming as you've used in JavaScript. I'm not going to go into that today because there will be too much material. But there are books such as Visualizing Data by the creator of this program, programming language. That will walk you through examples on how to do more complex visualizations. So here I'm also using the new construct, just as I use in object-oriented programming languages. So I'm creating a new array of 10 integers, and you also have to put the brackets in front of your array name. And you can replace this with string, float, whatever. The types are the same, except you also have defined bool. So bool is a defined type here. So for debugging, I would suggest you just use print lines. Works just like print file, except you can see in the console. And you can also add variables there, so you can visualize variables and stuff like that. It's fairly easy to debug. The properties for the draw can be set inside the setup function that gets called only once. Most variables. These are very useful for drawing stuff continuously. You have the current position, mouse X and mouse Y, but you also have the position of the previous time step, which is P mouse X and P mouse Y. And these are just internal to processing. You can just use them, and you can create, for instance, a line. And what I'm going to do here to show you animation. This is a continuous draw. It's exactly the same code as before. And if we run it, looks just like the paint brush inside paint. Okay, no. You also have the variables called mouse pressed. With if mouse pressed, you can also check if the mouse button that was pressed was left or right. So then you can do some kind of logic here with your code. You also have keyboard interaction, just like in C. You have the key pressed Boolean, and then you can check if it's some kind of alphanumeric key. You can also check if it's a coded key. You should check the reference manual for this. Whenever you say key equals equals coded, those are coded keys such as arrow keys, F1 through F12, things like that. So you can check the code for that. And you can do some kind of a game with left arrow, right arrow, and so on. Do some kind of motion. You can export media from processing, which is very cool. You can export to an image by saying save frame. You can export to a PDF. If you want to export to a PDF, you're going to import a new library. So just like we had include in C, the equivalent of that inside processing is called import, and then it's followed by the library. Now, this library may contain several files, so that's why I'm putting a star at the end, which means include all. You can just do that. And inside setup, you also, if you want to export as a PDF, you also have to specify in the window, you also have to put the fourth argument as the name of your output PDF file, and the third argument as PDF to specify the output type. And in the end of draw, you have to click, you have to type exit. So that's when the PDF is actually written to a disk. You can import media by saying, this is a reserved type of processing, pimage, img, and inside, that's declared at the top of your code, it's a global variable, and inside your setup, you can just say load image, JPEG, TIFF, GIF, whatever format you want. And then inside draw, you can just say image of img, 0, 0. These are just the coordinates of the top left corner of the image, wherever they're placed inside the canvas. So you can do some, you can, for instance, load a map here, a map of the United States, and then you can lay, add a layer of bubbles or bars or whatever you want to, however you want to represent your data on top of that map. Again, what I'm doing here is giving you building blocks. You can take them and build whatever you want creatively. But these should be, this should be an extensive reference. So you can also see if your mouse is inside a circle or a rectangle, or if it is, you can check bounds. To do that, you just use a distance function, dist of first point, second point, and that's basically just your Euclidean distance. Why you would want to use bounds, boundaries of circles and rectangles and distance function, if you want to add like buttons or tabs inside your visualization. You might want to see if you're inside that button, and if you're clicking that button, you might want to change the display to something else, which I'm going to demonstrate to you with a very simple example now. So here I've created a variable called d, which is a distance between mouse x, mouse y, and the position that I've defined there, which is the center of the circle. If d is less than the radius, I increase the radius, and I fit with black. Otherwise, I fit with white. And then I am changing this ellipse to be longer in the y-coordinate. That's why I said radius times 2. So we are going to run this. So we have this little ellipse here. When I'm putting my mouse on top of it, it turned black, and it keeps increasing. So another example for this is an actual button. You can create buttons as rectangles. To check here, I'm just checking if my mouse x and y positions are within the rectangle. So if the mouse x is larger than x, which is the top left corner of the rectangle, is less than the x plus the width of the rectangle, and same for y. Then we can do the same thing. We can fill the button with black, draw out a rectangle, and then we can also add some text, such as pressed. To add text, you simply set a text size, set a text alignment, can be left, right, or center. You have to give a fill color for the text separate from the fill color of the rectangle. As I mentioned, every time you declare the fill color, it stays the same for every subsequent geometric primitive you draw. So if you want to change it, you better call fill again with new parameters. And otherwise, the button returns to white. So let's run this. Okay, my computer is a little slow for this one. Ah, there you go. Okay, so it loaded, and now it tells you that, oh, I'm inside the button, it's pressed. I move it outside, it's no longer pressed. And you can use this kind of branching logic to, you know, you can set a Boolean variable here, my button is pressed, and then you can call a function in which you're drawing something. So you can have tabs inside your visualization. Or you can show different things on the same, let's say, map. So this is useful for that. Just close a few of these windows. Okay. So the way to declare a text, if you want to load some non-standard font, you will just have to declare a pfont. This is the type of the font, the font variable. Inside setup, I'm going to load the font. Inside the draw function, I'm going to set the font. And then we can say the text at position x, y, lolcat. So text is generally useful if you want to annotate something on your visualization, such as the values that you're plotting. So now I'm going to discuss a bit of 2D animation. So I showed you the Pac-Man example early on, similar to the bouncing ball classic game from the 70s, which you have a paddle and you bounce a ball off the paddle into walls. This is basically, you can basically check if your object is moving away from the canvas just by seeing if its x and y position are outside the bounds of this width and height. And then you can implement bouncing off walls, such as changing direction of the object. Any animation implementation would have to be inside draw, and basically you have to update your x and y coordinates of that object inside a draw function. And my example here, was this one. So in here, we have these bounds, width and height of the canvas. And we have defined a speed and a direction. The x coordinate of my object is x plus speed times direction. If x is outside is nearing the outside of my canvas, I'm flipping the direction, which will make it, the next time it loops over into the draw function, the x will go back. So that's how we had that. And also another issue here was orientation of the Pac-Man. You have to check that the orientation is correct, because otherwise the Pac-Man will just go backward with the same orientation as it had left to right. So I'm flipping the orientation here by saying if direction equals 1, that means going from left to right, I'm keeping that orientation. If not, I'm flipping the orientation of the Pac-Man. And that's basically the Pac-Man example. And when it's going to reach the wall, you will see that I'm actually flipping the orientation, which can simply be done just by having a direction variable on top, or a Boolean. Either one would achieve the same thing. And you can also use random to create. Random is just a function that takes these two bounds, is going to create some position between 0 and mouse x. And then we can create random ellipses around the Pac-Man, which I'm going to demo right now. OK, let's uncomment this code. So here I've just created a random x and a random y. And I'm going to put an ellipse at random x, random y. And this doesn't look great, but it's just to demonstrate how you can use random. There you go. You can see there's something oscillating there. So, and that's because my mouse isn't, yeah, there you go. So it computes the random position of that ellipse based on your mouse x and mouse y. So when I'm changing that, I'm changing the range for the x and y coordinates of those ellipses. Okay. You can also use a timer, which is quite nice. Since if you do any sort of animation, you might want to use a timer. The standard timer in processing is in milliseconds, so you can just call the millisecond function, which is here, and you can just declare a timer variable, an integer timer equals milliseconds. And then if you have some kind of logic inside your program, such as if time one larger than timer, do something, otherwise do something else, you can create a nice animation, 2D animation. And I will show you a circular motion example. So in the circular motion example, I'm simply doing the sine and the cosine for the x and y coordinates. That's basically just writing out the parametric equations for circular motion. And we will see a very slow circular motion. And you can create any sort of animation similarly. Okay, there are also geometric transformations that can be applied to whatever geometric primitives you're drawing. These transformations, such as translate, rotate, and scale, if you don't use some kind of boundary for their range, for the scope, they will unfortunately apply in sequence. So if you use translate of x1, y1, then translate again of x2, y2, the outcome will be that you're translating by x1 plus x2 and y1 plus y2. So if you're doing, let's say, planetary motion, that might be good because you might want the position of the moon to be relative to the position of the Earth. But if you don't want to do that, you might want to limit the scope of these geometric transformations. And we can do that by using the push matrix and the pop matrix functions. That's basically limiting the range of whatever transformations you have inside push and pop, and afterwards, those transformations no longer apply. So if I said push matrix translate of mouse x, mouse y of this rectangle, I'm going to translate the rectangle, but as soon as I exit the push-pop scope, the rectangle will not be translated by that amount. So, for example, we have this example here. It's very simple. The effect of the translate for this rectangle ends here, but if I'm also drawing a second rectangle, and this one will be mobile because I'm not applying a translation of mouse x and mouse y. So I'm applying translate of mouse x, mouse y to my first rectangle. I've set pop matrix. That transformation no longer applies. And here I'm applying a new translation that only applies to this rectangle. So if we run this, we will see exactly that. So I have a moving rectangle and this one here that doesn't do anything. Okay. I'm going to talk a bit about three-dimensional drawing in processing and OpenGL. While I can't go into the details of OpenGL as a library, there are plenty of resources online. What I'm going to demo to you is how you can create a three-dimensional animation or visualization in processing. So the basic building block is first, in your setup function, you need to say comma OpenGL. This will enable you to use whatever is inside the OpenGL library. Then there are a few more things that you can do in three dimensions, such as you can specify lighting. There are several types of lighting sources, a point light source, a directional light source, or an ambient light source. Ambient light is basically what we see in this room reflected off the walls. It's diffuse light. A directional light source is not a point source. It's simply a source that has some kind of width. For instance, the lights that we have on top of the CSFT lounge on the ceiling, those are directional light sources. And point light sources would be basically approximating a light source to just one point in terms of... these are very useful if you do more advanced applications. The camera, however, You can change the camera pretty easily. It has three sets of parameters. You have camera location, which is where exactly the camera is positioned, the camera orientation, which is the up vector of the camera. These are coordinates in X, Y, Z, and the camera target, which means where the camera points at. This is important if you want to do some kind of camera motion in some scene. You might want to modify the camera position, for instance. Then you can do, if you want to translate the camera, you can modify the camera X, Y, Z positions. If you want to zoom in and zoom out, you can modify the camera Z position. If you want to zoom in, you decrease the Z, so you close into the scene. If you want to zoom out, you increase the Z. And one more thing here is that the coordinate system is a bit odd. The positive Z axis is inside the screen. It's pointing toward the screen. That's just like the thing that you have. The upper left corner is your 0, 0, and the Z axis is pointing into the screen, the Y axis pointing down. So you have to be careful about that when you draw things on the screen. So I'm going to do a few examples here. Let's go to 3D example 2. Okay. So again, inside the setup function, there's no major difference between the two-dimensional case. We just have the OpenGL parameter as the third one. And you have to always import the 3D OpenGL library into processing whenever you do a 3D application. Similar to what we did before, we have vertices. However, the vertices are three-dimensional now. So everything that we discussed about in the two-dimensional case with creating your own shapes and stuff like that applies here identically. All you have to do is you have to add a third coordinate to the vertex, and that's pretty much it. And these are also bounded between begin shape and end shape because here I basically created a tile. When we're going to visualize this, we'll see that this is similar to the tiles on a roof. So again, the code here, you should be able to reproduce this entirely on your own. I'm just using basic building blocks as geometric transformations I've explained to construct this. And you can see with moving my mouse, we can see different angles of this. And it is a slanted tile, just like slanted row of tiles, just like on a roof. And you might wonder, well, I might not want to do a two-dimensional thing. You might want to do just like flat tiles with no width. You might want to use boxes instead. So I'm going to demo that. Yeah, you can see that with very few lines of coding, you can do pretty cool stuff in processing in terms of, okay, and my other example. So the only difference between this example and the previous one is that I've changed the begin shape and end shape to a box, which means I'm creating a cube in three-dimensional space. And if we run it, we'll see the same thing except we have cubes. And I've also changed the color from gray to white. But now I'm going to demo to you the camera. Oops, that's a bit ahead of. In my camera example, I have a float camera Z here variable. And the only important thing is inside here. With one call to the camera function, I can set the camera X, Y, Z position. That's the location of the camera. Then the target of the camera, which in this case is pointing toward the center of my canvas. So that's what the camera looks at. If you remember, the size of the window, width, and height, in this case, are keywords and represent the size of your canvas, the window you've created and set up. So I can just use width over 2 and height over 2 to point to the center of that canvas. And then you have the camera orientation vector, which just means the camera is pointing up in the 0, 1, 0 direction. And if we, and everything else is actually the same. So if we run, I've only used push and pop matrix to emphasize that whenever you have a bug with geometric transformations, check the scope of those transformations. That's why I always use push and pop to emphasize that point. Now, in this case, the change is that my camera position is actually being changed when I'm moving my mouse. As opposed to rotating the scene, I'm now rotating the camera. These have similar effects, except when you rotate, except you can also change things for the camera, such as zooming, panning, just by modifying these coordinates. Modifying the X and Y, you can pan. Modifying the Z, you can zoom. Okay. So in my more advanced application section, I'm going to talk about how you can get data from a table and how you can visualize the data set. So here you've defined your global table. This is where you get your data from. In your setup function, you will load the table. In the setup function, you can load a table by just saying new table of whatever path to that table. You don't need to include the path if you copy the text file inside your processing folder, the folder in which you're creating this program. You're also defining a row count, which is your table.getRowCount that simply automatically finds for you the row count. In this case, I'm basically going to get an X and Y coordinate from the table by just using .getFloat. GetFloat is a function defined in the table library of processing. The first parameter to that get function is the row. The second parameter is the column. And the way this is defined, it's a tab-separated value file, which means two consecutive values on the same row are separated by a tab. So you have to just keep that in mind when you create your data set. So my first example is a US map visualization. Again, the way you can get data from your file is table.get int, float, string, whatever data type you have, of row, comma, column. So to add a file to your code folder, remember I said anytime you include something in your sketch, such as an image, if you want to have like an image as your background, you have, or in this case, a data set, you always have to go on sketch, add file, and then processing will make a copy inside the local folder of your project, and you can use that file inside your program. And the cool thing about creating an applet, actually, creating a web applet using processing, is that it will include all those files automatically, and you don't have to do anything. You just export as applet, as web applet, and it creates a website for you with the applet, all the data, and you don't have to do anything else, which is pretty neat. So let's do a demo here. I think this is a bit more, one of the more advanced examples. So there's actually, you can go through a version of this. It's more complete in this book. You can find it at the Hollis, you can find it on Hollis, and I think there's several of these in the Cabot library. So this book is actually pretty good because it walks you through several examples of different visualization types. So I'm going to walk you through the first one. As I mentioned, I need to load a map. I'm going to take a map of the United States, and I'm going to plot some data on it. So we're going to load the map image. And to do that, we're going to have to do sketch, add file, and that will include a copy of that in the project folder. We're going to load a locations table file, and we're going to define some data max and data min bounds for the data set. And the rest is all the same as before. We just have the p image type for map image. You can see that the table is not a standard type. It's not a standard type because it's created inside a library that we've imported in here. That's not part of the standard processing libraries. That library is this one. that defines all those neat functions that I've explained to you. I will give you a download link for that library after this. Okay, so here what I want to do is I want to get the bounds of my data set. So we have a new table, we've loaded it, now we go into all the rows and we're going to check, is my current value larger than the maximum value that I have stored, which was float max, or is it less than the minimal value that I have stored? Then I will update those two. So I can get the bounds of my data set and I can scale things appropriately. I'm using smooth again for anti-aliasing, and no stroke just means we don't have a contour around the shapes we're going to draw. So inside the draw function, what we're going to do is we're going to get the data, just saying location table dot get float of row comma column. The first column in this data set is actually the x position. The second one is the y position, so it's very nicely laid out for us. And we can also get a row name using the data table, which is a separate table from this one. And then I'm calling, you see, we've created a new function here called drawData that we're calling inside draw. Every time we're reading a row, we're calling drawData, which basically what this will do, it will put a bubble at the x, y position. And that bubble will signify, as we see, the radius of the bubble will be represented by a variable in data set. So you can create your own function in processing quite easily. You basically just declare it. You don't need to do any kind of function prototype. All you need to do is the function parameters, and then you define your function. And then you can call it inside the draw. So the draw data function is just supposed to draw one bubble at a time. Maybe I should show you guys first the actual outcome of this so it makes more sense. So this is the outcome of the visualization. We have a map of the United States. We have bubbles of different sizes corresponding to the radius of the bubble corresponds to a variable in the second data set. The x and y position corresponds to the first data set. So, and I've also added interaction with data set so that, sorry, my computer is very slow, so that when you hover over one of these bubbles, it will give you the value and the name of the state. So I'll walk through how you can do all that interaction. So that's the outcome. What we've loaded here were two data sets, one for the XY coordinates, the second one for the values that are printed here. And we've also loaded the map itself as an image, which is the background of our canvas. Okay, so the draw data function actually does the whole interaction, the drawing itself, everything. We are calling that function every time we read in a row. Every time we've read a row from the location table, we've called draw data, we've created a bubble. Okay, so the actual interaction is done here. If distance between x, y, which we're taking from the data set, and your current mouse x and mouse y position were less than the radius of that bubble, we're going to print something on top of the bubble, and I'm going to change the fill color of the bubble. This is a very simple interaction that you can do. And I forgot to mention to you, but you can also use hex color values for the fill function. Just as you use in HTML hex colors, you can use that here as well, instead of saying RGB values. So whatever is easier for you. And we have, again, the table. The table class is defined for you inside this library. You don't have to worry about it. You just know that it has all those nice features that I've shown you, such as get row count, get float, get int, get string, and the actual functions to load a table. And the way you can tell that this is not a standard type, that it's not highlighted in orange, such as the type table is not prepended by p, which would be a processing standard type, such as p image, and it's not highlighted in orange, which means it's a type that we defined. inside this library that we imported. So yeah, you can see that we've done that visualization with 64 lines of code. Okay, so the really good advantage about processing is very easy to debug. It's very easy to create cool visualizations of data sets. And really what this allows you to do is really focus on how you can interact with the user. Focus how you can highlight things in your data set. Because the building blocks are so easy to use that the time should be spent on how you make a visualization be more useful for whoever is going to view it. And so that you can interact more with the user. It's a richer view of your data sets. That's basically what you should focus on. Because the programming itself should be fairly straightforward. And generally in processing, if you go on processing.org, you'll find examples, you'll find tutorials. There are plenty of books on it. Probably if you've tried something, probably someone did before you. So you can always go to something to refer. You always have something to refer to in this language, which is pretty nice. Okay. So as I mentioned to you, you have to download a library for this to work. The library, if you use a TSV dataset, the library to download is here, benfry.com. That's the author of the language. And you just download this. You copy it inside your project folder by saying sketch add file table PDE. And then you will see that, that PDE, which is processing source file, in a different tab. I suggest you don't edit that file because, you know, it's just, yeah. Don't edit the file, but you can take a peek through it to understand how exactly it works. That would be a nice exercise. And that's our outcome. With less than 70 lines of code, you can create an interactive map. And what I wanted to show you guys was that this is the processing website, processing.org. You see we have here learning, reference, and you have play with examples, which is really neat. There are plenty of examples here. But what I wanted to show you was that the New York Times and other famous websites, this is the New York Times, use visualizations like this in their articles to emphasize connections in large data sets. In this case, these are tweets doing a game, and we can see the most popular tweets over the timeline of the game, which is pretty interesting. And really doing this kind of visualization is not hard with processing. It will take maybe 150 lines of code. But it's really not hard to create something like this, which is one of the advantages of the language. OK, my second example, I guess, would be even easier for you guys, because it is even more well implemented than the map example. There's a library called TreeMap. I know several students are doing WordMap examples, such WordMap file projects, such as loading a novel and trying to compare, let's say, relationships between words in different chapters, between words in different sentences, and stuff like that. You can really do a lot of stuff just by reading the instructions in this library, the TreeMap library. You can read Chapter 7 of Visualizing Data, the book I showed you earlier, this one. And if you read Chapter 7 and you go through the source code inside this library, I'm pretty sure you'll be able to do any sort of word map you might want. And one of the really cool word map examples, and this is created by IBM, is the Many Eyes project. In which you can basically see relationships between words inside a sentence. So, and you can go back. You can take a different part of the sentence. Okay. And what we're going to go through is an example of from this book, which is creating a word map of twains following the equator You can get the data set from this site. And I also encourage you, if you're doing any sort of word map, you should try to create some small, very small test data set, just to make sure, maybe a few paragraphs. Create your own data set first, and then expand to like something huge. Because the runtime of this kind of application will take a while, and you know, just better to start with something small that you can debug easily. But if you want some data set, if you don't have a data set, there's one available here. So that might be helpful. Take any sort of word map visualization. Okay. The outcome of this will be this type of visualization. What we see here are the words that are represented with the highest frequency inside Mark Twain's text. These have larger size. And then you can enhance this by, you could have some sort of hovering. If you hover over a word, it will then expand to show connections between that word and other words and things like that. So you can definitely augment this with user interaction quite easily, as I've shown you with the building blocks earlier today. However, creating this particular visualization is really not hard. And I will show you that most of the functions you need to create this are already done for you in the library that I've linked to. So creating this is not hard. What will be hard here is basically figuring out how you can show something interesting about your data set, which is, again, what I strongly encourage you to spend your time on. One of my students mentioned that, well, it's not very interesting to show all these very short words. So like it, the, and, to, in, a, I, these are not very informative. So what you might want to do is parse your data set first, remove all these really short words, and then try to reveal relationships between more complex, more interesting words than just three-letter words. One easy way to do that would be just use processing to go through your file, check the length of the string of that particular word. If it's less than 4, just remove it and create a new file and use that file as your input to the program. So I'm going to walk through this example with you. And I'm going to magnify the text. Let's see. Is this good enough? Yeah, OK. So here you can see there are three files. Two of these files are given to us. One of them is created. One of them you'll have to write, but the two of the other files are given to you. The word map class is part of the library. The word item class is part of the library. And the tree map file is what we actually write. Again, to be able to include a custom library such as the one from To be able to include this kind of library from here, what you do is you copy the library folder inside your processing project folder, and you restart processing. Processing will recognize that you have the library in the folder. Then you go on Sketch, Add Library, and you can then add your library. And inside your actual code, you must say import treemap.star, which means import all files associated with this library. Basically, a set of libraries that pertain to TMAP. And again, I highly encourage you to go and explore these libraries, to have a deep understanding of what's going on there. I think if you do a processing file project, the amount of code shouldn't be that large. It should be mostly the amount of thinking you put into it on how to reveal something interesting about your data set. So a lot of this stuff is implemented already for you. You can see that treemap is not a standard processing type. It's a type defined in that library, so again, it's not highlighted. We've created a treemap map, a larger size of our window inside setup. Here I've created, this is interesting, I've created an array of strings, and I can just say string array of called lines equal load strings. Load strings is a function defined in processing. You can just You can just load the strings from equator.txt. All those strings will be parsed inside the will be included inside the lines library, and then you can go through each line in that file and do some kind of processing over it, some kind of data manipulation. So load strings basically just takes everything between the starting character of a line and the backslash n, and that's included inside that's line of I, basically. Every line is inside the equator.txt file. And lines also has the dot length property, which means you can easily loop through this array. And I have the add word function defined inside map data. So we can just say map data dot add word of lines of I. And then this is another function that is defined inside the function inside the library. And now we've created a new tree map of map data. Corner 0, 0, that's the top left corner of the tree map, and width of height. Remember, width and height are variables that are defined internal to processing. What they mean is the width and the height of your canvas, which means you can refer to them later on in the program after you've created the size. These are, width and height are just the values that you've passed to size here, 1024 and 768. So. And now this is interesting. I said no loop here. You say no loop if you want the draw function to be called only once. In the case of a tree map, we don't have any sort of animation, so there's no point. It's computationally expensive. To compute the actual tree map is very computationally expensive, so you want to just draw it once. And the draw function itself is literally just two lines. I've set the background to white. And then we have the draw function inside the map object. You say map.draw. Remember, we've defined the map here. Map equals new tree map. Tree map is the constructor for the map object. It takes the map data, the top left corner of the tree map, the width and the height. And we've just set map.draw, and let's see what happens. As I mentioned to you, this takes a while to actually render. Magic. So with less than 30 lines of code, you can create your own tree map, which is quite powerful. Now, the challenge for whoever will choose to do a tree map project, a word map project, will be to massage the data set to reveal some interesting connections in the words. So as I mentioned to you, creating this actual word map takes only 30 lines of code, which is very nice because all these functions are defined for you. Now your challenge will be to take the data set that you want to visualize and try to change the data in such a way that you filter out the non-interesting stuff for the purpose of your project, such as these connector words, and create a new data set that is filtered, that has filled out that non-useful information, and then reveal in some sort of interactive visualization to the user relationships between words and maybe timelines of certain words and things like that. I've seen several very interesting projects in my project proposals in my students section, and I'm very excited for the projects they're going to create with this. So creating a word map is not hard. I'll walk through this very short code one more time. We've created a map object, a tree map object. We've imported the library, and what we're doing in this block is basically just getting the map data. There's a data structure called map data. You can read about it in the library. And we've created the actual map object here by loading the map data into the tree map. This is a constructor of the map object. We have map data, top left corner coordinates, width and height, which are the size of the canvas. And this is how we've created our tree map object right here. We're pretty much done. At this point, all we have to do is we have to call the map.draw function. The draw function is defined in the tmap library. And you can just call it the object name, in this case map.draw, and that's it. So that's all you need to do. One way to enhance this would be to just create buttons or tabs at the top of the window, and then you could visualize different tmaps by clicking on those tabs. Another way would be to, and you can do this, the library provides this functionality. You could hover over a word, click on it, and then the tmap would expand to reveal the connections between those words and do things like that. There's also a network library which replaces these boxes with basically just bubbles and connections between those bubbles. So you could also try that. But this is very easy to do. And finally, I'm going to... So as I mentioned, you should just focus on enhancing the user interaction. And finally, I'm going to explain to you how to get your own data set. So for the final project, you can either create a data set of your own, or you can take some in TSV format, or you can take some already existing text, such as a Mark Twain novel, or Tolstoy, or some large text. And you can use a scripting language, such as Python, which should be fairly easy to learn. Combined with regular expressions to do pattern matching, and then you can select words that specify some particular constraints. For web scraping, you can use Python with the library called Beautiful Soup. What this library allows you to do is do HTML tag parsing. So it has functions inside that allow you to parse the content between some particular tags, which is very useful if you want to get your data set from a website, for instance, such as the register website. Writing an actual Python script to do this kind of stuff would be probably less than 100 lines of code, so it shouldn't be too bad at all. Make sure that the Python file you output is in TSV format. The way to do this is just whenever you write to the file, put a tab between subsequent data values. And if you want to do more complicated things than what's allowed to do by than what you're allowed to do by Beautiful Soup, you can look into the regular expression library inside Python. I would suggest you look at the following functions: re.match, re.search, and find. That would be the third function. Find allows you to search for a particular string or substring. And if you follow this regular expression library, you should be able to create your data set however complex you want to be. I recommend the following references. You should install processing from processing.org. And inside that folder, you will see examples. Those examples should walk you through a lot of all the things that we've discussed today. A very good book is called Learning Processing. It's this orange book by Schiffman. Learning Processing is basically an extensive reference of all the functions and simple examples of what you can do with those functions in processing. The second book is called Visualizing Data, which is more of a case studies book. So I've referred to it 3 times already, but it's a very good book. I recommend you guys read it. So this book contains a lot of code examples and a lot of ways to really enhance the experience for your users, which is what we're focusing on when we're doing a visualization, and really revealing things in your data set that might not be visible without a good visualization. So this is a very good reference book if you want to create more complicated tree maps, for instance, or other visualizations. And of course, go on processing.org/reference to see more information. Now, processing is not the only language. It's open source. It has its limitations. If you want to do more visually appealing visualizations, you might want to look into Flash and the Microsoft Silverlight software. Those we'll provide you, since you have to, we'll provide you more, possibly more functionality than processing. The natural continuation, if you do a final project like a visualization final project, would be to take CS171 next semester. It will walk you through case studies of visualizations and will teach you all you need to know to do compelling visualization of data sets in physics, chemistry, biology, whatever your field is. This is a very useful class to do. And it's very easy to take it off CS50 since the amount of the learning, you don't have to do any algorithms or anything else other than just know how to program. Everything else will be taught inside the course. So I highly recommend to take it. And that's it. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.